As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Welcome to Strange Familiars. If you've seen something strange, like a cryptid, an alien, a ghost, anything paranormal, or if you know of a story you think we should cover, you can email us strangefamiliarspodcast@gmail.com. So tonight we have a very special episode of Strange Familiars.
Aren't they all special?
They are all special.
But this is very special.
It's special to me.
Okay.
People have been clamoring for this episode. At least one person has been clamoring.
That was you, right?
No, someone did ask for this. Like, when is the Where the Footprints End episode of Strange Familiars coming?
So now you'll know where the footprints end. Actually, we didn't talk about that in the interview.
Not exactly. This was, so far, and I'm not just saying this because we live together, honestly, my favorite interview I've done for Where the Footprints End so far.
I feel like it wasn't so much an interview about the book, but sort of like where we are with Bigfoot right now, generally.
Yeah, I
Bigfoot
feel that.
Zeitgeist.
I mean, there's definitely a lot of book in there, in the interview, but like the best interviews, I think the book was a springboard to further discussions. And I had a lot of fun doing it. It was a great conversation with you and Josh. I think I say at the beginning, this is what you get, meaning there was only one episode, but it ended up being a two-parter. So
we ended up talking for a long time.
We talked for so long, this will be a two-parter. So without further ado, let's go ahead and get to our wide-ranging interview, Where the Footprints End, High Strangeness and the Bigfoot Phenomenon, Volume 1, Folklore, a book written by myself, Timothy Renner, and Joshua Cutchin. You can find it on Amazon or get copies from our Etsy shop. You can find links in the show notes at strangefamiliars.com.
Yeah, so I think it's interesting that right as we start to think about recording, we get the first actual thunderstorm we've had in like 2 weeks. it's like beginning to Riders on the Storm.
Yeah, it's the wild hunt.
It is. Yeah. Start the drumming.
So we are finally, after Josh and I have been on, I think pretty much every other podcast that exists, except Strange Familiars and Where Did the Road Go, we're finally going to do a talk about Where the Footprints End on Strange Familiars.
I have to say, you just squeaked in as far as being invited on. It was only because someone else decided that they were going to cancel for the evening that you guys even made it onto the show tonight.
It's just because only reason I have this slot is because I've shared a hotel room with the host. So.
Yeah, exactly. Tonight, though, the host is not Tim. I'm the host tonight.
Yes, Allison is running the show. Allison is going to be interviewing Josh and I tonight, and I have to say, I'm a little scared.
As well, you should be. Even Bigfoot's quaking right now.
We're finally going to sit down and talk about our book, Where the Footprints End, High Strangeness and the Bigfoot Phenomena, Volume 1. So I guess I will welcome Josh and Allison to the show, and then Allison's going to take over with the questioning. Welcome, guys.
I'm happy to be here, always. Worst comes to worst, you can always count on me to show up whenever you need me for Strange Familiars. We should have like a monthly check-in with Josh and see how grumpy he is.
My original plan for Where the Footprints End was, when it came out, I wanted to do a series of shows on Strange Familiars with you and I talking about various topics from the book, and then we just got so busy doing every other show that just became impossible. At some point, I realized, well, we can't do that. So tonight's what we're going to get. We'll see. Maybe we'll do another one down the road. But
anybody who's listening, you're going to be hearing about this book all the way through the end of October, probably, because we still have a backlog of even more interviews.
Yeah. Yeah. I wasn't exaggerating when I said we were doing every podcast in the world.
I think the term is whore. You guys are being whores, whores for Bigfoot, which actually segues nicely into the beginning of my interview.
All right. Oh, I should mention before we start that Allison has a game of, rather a Bigfoot bingo card that she has tonight. Now, she will not be interrupting the interview to let us know when we've hit a bingo. In other words, she's got some Bigfoot phrases on a bingo card.
That's amazing.
At the end of the interview, she's going to let us know how many we've ticked off.
And perfect. I'm going to attempt not to tick off any audience members, but I can't swear to that because I'm not sure how this is going to go. The smooth-voiced Tim will be replaced by my sort of awkward Bigfoot quandaries.
Well, your free centerpiece should be Archetype. That should be your
oh,
free. That,
oh, man. Oh, yep. Yeah, there we go. Free space. Actually, I had a different center square, but I'm sure we're going to get it anyway.
I think I know what that is.
I don't know. I don't know that you do.
Okay.
All right. This will probably not be as seamless as the typical hosting duties, but I'm just going to start off with a pretty generic, I wouldn't say softball, but just sort of a generic question that can lead you down a path. And that is, why are we seeing Bigfoot now? Not me personally, but why are people seeing Bigfoot now? And this could be for whoever wants to go.
I have kind of a working idea of that because, I mean, we are at the height of Bigfoot popularity, at least in the past, I'd say probably 2 or 3 decades.
Oh, yeah.
So yeah, I'm saying that it's in my lifetime, at least. And I think that maybe, you know, looking at Bigfoot through an archetypal lens about being some sort of, you know, hybrid of man in the wild and, you know, the ape, I think that it almost is sort of calling us back to being more in tune with our world, more in tune with the environment. I mean, if you look at what's happening in the world, even beyond what we're doing, it almost feels like, you know, Gaia is gearing up for a sneeze or something. and I think that there might be some sort of loose correlation. It's an idea that I'm playing with, that the reason that people are seeing so much Bigfoot is not only has the stigma been removed, but also maybe there actually is a ramp up in activity that's sort of somehow tied into bringing us back to a more natural focus. I mean, the number of, you know, victory gardens, so to speak, that have mm-hmm. cropped up in my neighborhood has skyrocketed, and I see a lot of people going back more towards the earth. People are enjoying parks because there's nothing else to do, and I think that may be the thing that's sort of gaining momentum. This sort of, I don't want to say back to earth because it's a little bit cheesy, but this sort of return to our roots, and maybe that might have something to do with the manifestation of this particular phenomena.
And do you think that perhaps it's just a return to the past generally, in the same way that we were for so long in sort of like an alien epoch, if you want to say, and then we were looking forward, space was going to be the answer, the future was the answer, and now the future's so scary that we're just returning to our sort of base roots in the past?
Well, I'm going to make a confession here that I don't think I've made anywhere, is that I find space boring. which is partially probably has something to do with the idea that I'm on sort of more of a fairy faith hypothesis than an extraterrestrial hypothesis with the UFO thing. So this makes me, pleased as punch. But I think you're kind of right. There's been this sort of, it's been like this technological juggernaut that we've been riding. And that's, of course, tied into, if you look at when UFOs took off, that was sort of the beginning of the atomic age, and spacefaring and all those things were sort of in the script that we're acting out. And I think maybe we're seeing sort of a change in acts, if you will.
Well, I feel like it's kind of been a race starting with, like Darwinian theories between, space, the future, and these missing link ideas and the lost apes and such, that maybe these two ideas have been racing parallel to one another the whole time, gaining and losing momentum. And maybe right now Bigfoot's just winning.
This dovetails so nicely with an idea that we really get into in Volume 2, but we talk about a lot as regards Volume 1, and this is the idea of the changing wild man archetype. Mm. So we put down this idea that Bigfoot is a archetype of the wild man. So we have always, we being humanity, we've always had these wild men that have lived in the wilderness next to us, all over the world. We can name off, the Yeti in Asia and the various, Wadwos and various wild men throughout Europe, Bigfoot and Oma and Sasquatch and all of the different names for these wild men in the Americas, all over the world, wherever people have lived, wild men have lived in the wilderness next to them. But this wild man archetype seems to, at least in the West, change over time. And we start out with these medieval Wadwoses, and Allison, actually, in the room you're in, if you look across from you, there's a picture of Merlin, and that is actually Merlin in his wild man stage. Merlin was considered a wild man himself, and at least in one stage of his life. So these medieval wild men were very much wise and wizardly. They had magic and wisdom, and they kind of change over time, and they move up until you get to the Victorian era, and the Bigfoot collections that I wrote, the Bigfoot in Pennsylvania and Bigfoot West Coast Wild Man, and there's more on the way, these collections of these Victorian articles that talk about the wild men of the time, often, not always, but often in these articles, they're either portrayed as wearing clothes or even carrying like old rusty muskets. And in the past, I attributed that to the Victorian culture being kind of prudish, and perhaps,
which is a good idea.
Yeah,
it's a good idea. Yeah,
perhaps that they were clothing these wild men. In other words, they couldn't bear the idea of a naked wild man running around in the woods. So the editor or the reporter would just throw torn up clothes on this wild man.
Oh, like in Italian paintings where they go back in and paint over the cherubs.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
Or I'm thinking of like the way that people got aroused by the legs on furniture or something, right? Wasn't that a thing?
Yeah. That was my original kind of hypothesis with that. But I've changed my thinking over time. And now I think maybe that's what people were seeing. And the reporting was accurate. And we have this wild man that's wearing torn up clothes in the Victorian times and carrying, non-functional rusty muskets that he's still carrying around, that muskets that won't fire. Even sometimes they talk about seeing these creatures cooking over fires, or at least, having a campfire. Until you get to the modern day, where Bigfoot is this very, very wild creature, this very, very wild, wild man. It's very savage and animalistic. So it seems this wild man archetype is changing. It's going from the sophisticated to the more wild, less like us in other words, closer to nature, I guess.
Is that possibly because of the dangerous nature of a choice to become a wild man versus just being born a wild man? You know, that Victorian idea of, like, that could be possibly be a person who has chosen to go and live in the wild as opposed just to...
There absolutely was Bigfoot, that idea.
Seems to be born of this and hasn't chosen that life, has always been here in some respects.
I mean, there absolutely was that idea in the Victorian times, even in the medieval times, that you could choose to become a wild man. You could leave society and become wild. And I think you've noted this before, at least in our private conversations, Allison, that it always is a dangerous thing to leave society. That it was anyone who walks away from society is considered somewhat dangerous.
And we even just, a lot of the other things that are associated with Bigfoot are still seen as people who are sort of bordering on social mores, you know, people with long hair, people who are poor, you know, like these are things that are still like dangerous concepts within our culture.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to step back to finish my archetype metaphor here and talk about, because we were talking about UFOs and technology, the UFO always stays ahead of us, technologically speaking. People were seeing blimps and airships. You know, we did our airship show before that, you know, we actually had functioning blimps and airships. And then they moved to these like Art Deco kind of flying saucers and so forth in the 40s and 50s. And by the 70s, there are these very kind of Star Wars-like giant black triangles that are flying through the skies. And until nowadays, we have like plasma balls and like shape-shifting light forms and all these things. So the UFO gets more technologically advanced. The wild man seems to get more primitive. And I do not know if that's a reaction to us moving away from nature. In other words, as mankind gets further away from nature, more, you know, locked in our cities, locked in our suburbs, interacting less with nature, does our wild man become wilder? Does it, by necessity, does the wild man, you know, become wilder? That our connection to the wild, is it that much more removed from us? You know, it's wilder in a sense. So that's an idea we play with, like I said, a little bit more in Volume 2, but it's sort of the subtext of Volume 1.
Well, and I love that idea, and it's something that Chris mentioned on the last episode of Where Did the Road Go that you were on, which is this idea that, you know, maybe this transition is sort of echoed and encoded, rather, in Merlin, who, you know, lived his life backwards. You know, I thought that was an interesting insight,
yes.
which you've got to add to your chapter in Volume 2 where you talk about this. But, you know, it sort of leaves me wondering, like, if we become uber technological, which, I mean, I think even as wild, even as not wild, but even as tamed as we've made the world, there's still plenty of room to pave over everything. If we pave over the earth, does Bigfoot literally turn into, like, a capuchin monkey? Or, like, what does he go to? Does he turn into a protoplasm of, you know, how far does he regress?
Right. Or we start to see things coming out of the ocean in very, very small steps.
Right. Well, fair enough. There's that ocean connection. Is that what you're thinking of, Tim?
Yeah, yeah. There are mersquatches.
Oh, here we go.
Yeah, it's not talked about that much, but there are a lot of strange similarities between mermaids and Bigfoot. You know, we think of mermaids as being, or merfolk, I guess I should say, and Bigfoot. We think of mermaids and merfolk and mermen as being sort of like, you know, completely human on the top and fish-like on the bottom. But oftentimes they were kind of a variation on the wild men archetype, to the extent that wild men sometimes would dwell in pools of water, and that some wild men would explicitly live in the water. I mean, that make a reference in Volume 1 of the fact that, you know, you think of Grendel, which some Bigfoot researchers are all like, oh, Grendel was a Bigfoot. Well, Grendel's mother lived, you know, in the water.
But are they
so,
both
sort you know, of I think that there's some merit to that. And so it's interesting when you couple these older wild man concepts with current sightings of Bigfoot that are not only seen swimming very adeptly through the water, which is something that apes, generally speaking, don't do. But also, I mean, the vast distances that they can sometimes travel. And we have some examples in the book of people who see swamp apes in the Gulf of Mexico. And apparently it's a very common thing off of the southern coast of Alaska to see a Bigfoot out at sea. And so it really is interesting that you see that older idea being reflected in Bigfoot, you know, sightings, but you don't really hear about it that much. I mean, you'll find it in indigenous pockets, and you'll find it, you talked about, in regional sightings, but as far as the community, there's not a lot of acknowledgement, I don't think, of that aspect of whatever this is.
So are they supposed to be kind of like sirens, sort of beckoning you towards the wild in the same way that mermaids would beckon sailors?
Well, I mean, yeah, kind of. I mean, there's a connection between the mermaid and the wild man also, and just the way that they cry, but also the way that they cry more during storms. The idea of the wild, there's an excerpt from a medieval poem that I put in the book that's talking about the wild man whose cry laments just the same way as the siren does during storms, which is an interesting little connection there as well. As far as like luring sailors or luring people to their doom, I've never heard about luring, that on the water, but
or luring people to the wild.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's almost like it's the land. It's the all terrain version of the mermaid, I guess, maybe luring people into the woods as opposed to luring people out to sea. But that's something that, you know, phenomena do.
But isn't that kind of what the folkloric aspect of it was meant to prevent you from doing? Like, because I feel like so much of folklore has this sort of moralizing cautionary tale aspect to it. So isn't part of it that you are not supposed to follow either that path or that person into the woods in the same way you're not supposed to follow the fairies?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, and that's where, you know, I think in Thieves in the Night, I mentioned that there was a scholar that was talking about, like, well, nobody really believed in this. These were, you know, ways to sort of be cautionary tales for, you know, young people to not go into these wild places where they might encounter very real dangers. But at the same time, I don't think if you look at the folklore of any of these situations, that doesn't really bear itself out. I mean, if that's the case, then why do you have old spinsters in Ireland still leaving out, you know, milk for the fairies? It just doesn't compute. Obviously, adults took these things very seriously as well.
And yeah, it wouldn't be sustaining. Yeah. It wouldn't be sustaining if, it, like, folklore wouldn't last if it wasn't sustaining and self-perpetuating in some level.
Yeah, I mean, it's how many adults do you know that? Sorry, spoiler alert, kids. How many adults do you know actually still believe in the objective reality of Santa Claus or the Easter Bunny? We don't. And that's sort of what this particular scholar, I wish I could recall his name off the top of my head, but that's what he was saying, is that these are just sort of that equivalent, and that just doesn't make any sense. There's got to be something that people are encountering objectively that, even if it's not, you know, a wild man, there's got to be some sort of objective impetus or genesis for a lot of these different myths and legends and folklore.
And we'll get back to our discussion about where the footprints end in a moment. Skillshare is an online learning community where you can find thousands of classes to inspire your creativity, explore new skills, and deepen your knowledge of existing skills. Because it's online learning, they have classes that'll fit your skill level, whatever it is, from beginner on up, and you can take the classes anytime because they're online. So you're a Skillshare member now, Allison, as am I.
Mm-hmm.
You've been taking some classes there. I know you took the Design Great Stuff, How to Make Merch with Draplin class.
I did. It was a very like DIY, old school kind of punk rock approach, but with very practical ways to get your items actually made, which is something that I think if you're just starting out trying to market your business, that you don't really have those tools. Like, how do I get a pin made, or how do I prep these designs to actually give them to someone? And he gives really practical advice on how to get those things accomplished.
That's awesome. Besides the Design Great Stuff class, you were looking at some classes on alternate photography?
Yeah, I actually took one of the classes on alternate photography processes.
So there's all kinds of classes there at Skillshare. Skillshare members get unlimited access to all these classes, thousands of classes on Skillshare. Hands-on projects from a community of millions. Skillshare is very affordable, especially when you compare it to in-person classes and workshops. An annual subscription to Skillshare is less than $10 a month. Explore your creativity and get 2 months of premium membership at skillshare.com/strange. That's 2 whole months of unlimited access to thousands of classes for free. Get started and join today. Go ahead and head over to skillshare.com/strange. That's 2 free months of unlimited access to thousands of classes at skillshare.com/strange.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes, so doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Well, one thing I wanted to touch on, and I was kind of like flippantly talking to Tim about how I wanted to write a feminist Bigfoot book, which no one would ever read. But I thought maybe we could touch on that a little bit.
To be fair, you know, we keep on saying wild men, but, you know, wild mm-hmm. women factor into this as well. Just a quick interjection there.
In what capacity? I mean, as the sort of... you know, just because of the women in white who appear alongside these sightings, or literal feminine Bigfoot.
Oh no, explicit. I mean, they usually appear as ogresses, but these ogresses are described as, you know, devouring children and having, you know, large pendulous breasts, which appear in plenty of Bigfoot reports, and you know, and being completely covered in hair. I mean, and if you extend this a little bit more, it's pretty much accepted by medieval scholars that the wild woman archetype is sort of one of the shames sharing that same space as witches did. You know, they lived in the margins of society in the woods, and they were, you know, a deterrent, and they would sometimes abduct children. Sort of fits that same archetype.
Which is, well, by the way, something, Allison, you said to me a long time ago when I was doing research for one of the Bigfoot books. You said, wild women will always be witches.
Well, I mean, are they witches because there's like a negative connotation to that? Like, witches aren't primarily youthful, sexual, attractive women, like women in white.
I mean, yeah, historically, that's the case. I mean, the definition has certainly changed now into a, you know, an archetype of female empowerment. But in every culture throughout the world, it was never really that. I mean, you would have cunning men and women, and you would have, you know, fairy doctors and all these sorts of helpful magical practitioners. But like, when people said a witch, they generally meant not someone you want to hang out with.
And we were talking about empowerment versus disempowerment, and how so often it's these teenage girls or that have these sort of this supposed psychokinetic energy. And to me, it seems very disempowering because you're telling young women, particularly, that their burgeoning sexuality, you know, causes things to fly around the room and is this negative element that's just sort of lurking around them, in the same way that when you take a woman in white and juxtapose her with a wild man, you have this like constant fight between the good and the evil and the sexual and the non-sexual. And I think that it's actually sort of disempowering. There's a lot of those moralizing messages.
Wow.
That's an interesting and insightful angle that I do not feel at all qualified to speak about. But it makes sense. Well, it's kind of, not to veer too far, of course, but it's this idea that women need to seek some sort of external power source rather than actually calling upon the power inside themselves that you see in that, I think.
You guys talk a lot about the similarities between poltergeist activity in the outdoors being the similar to Bigfoot phenomenon in the same way that someone might experience it within their own household. So I was wondering, maybe we could speak to that on some level.
In terms of poltergeist activity manifesting around young women or just in general?
Well, just in general, but isn't the common notion that it's usually, they never come out and say it, right? That it's like some sort of hormonal thing that's bringing it on. But that's the assumption, like this time of extreme emotion or...
People have documented and charted when poltergeist activity tends to occur. And it is more often in prepubescent and just prepubescent, like right before they hit puberty, girls. And it does pop up around young men as well, male children. They tend to get it earlier, if I remember correctly. The poltergeist activity would be more, like late toddler age around boys. And this is just generally speaking. This isn't a hard and fast rule. It can appear, to people of any age and so forth. But
from like a Victorian aspect of it, because like that's the point in time when little boys would have been changed out of dresses and they would have reached a certain kind of proto-manhood anywhere from between 3 and 8 years old.
Oh, isn't that interesting? You're talking about like the unbreached boys versus...
Yeah.
That is a really, really interesting idea that I've never considered.
Well, and even more interesting too is the fact that, there are multiple reasons for, dressing young boys in dresses, but at least one of them that I've heard cited many times is that you wanted to sort of confuse the faithful because young boys were prized for changelings more than girls. So it's interesting that as soon as you put them in, young boys' clothing, that might be when it starts. It's an interesting angle that I hadn't considered. Another sort of wrinkle on this too, this whole conversation about sex and poltergeist, which I promise folks we'll come back to Bigfoot, but this is all kind of this big soup. It's all this big soup of stuff. Your mileage of spiritualism may vary, and there are plenty of, well-known male mediums, but when you think of sort of the quintessential spirit medium back in those days, it was, oftentimes a woman.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why I bring that in, because the two places that you see poltergeist activity are in poltergeist infestations and seances, the wrappings and the levitation.
Yeah, all the Fox sisters, early spiritualists.
Right,
And all the way back to the Salem witch trials. Basically, they just blamed all of the Salem witch trials on some teenage girls.
Speaking of the Salem witch trials, did you know that Tituba had a Bigfoot sighting?
All right, bring it. I've never heard this story.
More specifically, you could say a Littlefoot sighting.
a hairy creature sighting.
Yeah, it's interesting because this also sort of comes in to play when you're talking about fairies. People think that fairies are always short, which is a pretty good rule, but they can be of all shapes and sizes and often fold in aspects of the Wildman archetype. But, a lot of these sort of brownie variants that you see, which, Bogles and Peckamberlin and brownies and even goblins were described as short little simian hair-covered creatures. And Tituba, who was, the Caribbean slave who was at the center of the witch trials, saw what she described as a hairy thing with its face was hairy and it had a long nose and walked around on two legs and was about 3 foot high. So, and people do still see to this day, not only, when people see in the forest something of that description, they now assume in North America that, it's a Littlefoot, it's a juvenile Bigfoot. People have seen these things alongside larger Bigfoot. But, if you unpack your assumptions, maybe they're the same thing. And one of them is just in, big mode and one of them's in tiny mode because, again, wild men and fairies, just like witches, were also inveterate mimics and shapeshifters as well.
And extending this to the spiritualism movement, we talk about manifestation of hairy creatures.
Yeah, people don't really like to talk about that either. Isn't it funny how we wrote this book about high strangeness and Bigfoot and people didn't really like to talk about these things? Yeah, hairy hands are one of those things that appear in numerous seances, and there are at least two examples that I can think of in one example, specifically an actual, what we would describe as a Bigfoot, and in another example, the lighting was so dim that the witness, whom I believe was Stan Gooch, who was a paranormal writer, described what looked like a Neanderthal, and he wasn't sure whether or not it was, you know, clad in furs or it was furry all over, but it was a large furry man shape that manifested in the room.
Oh yeah, and like typically I would just think of sort of this like vague ectoplasm is what I would think of as like your typical seance output. I hadn't heard any of the stories about hairiness involved in it.
I wouldn't say that. Well, that's sort of the problem that you run into some of this literature is people say hairy hands. Now, does that mean like a completely hairy hand, or does that mean, you know, Andre the Giant's hand? I don't know.
Yeah, or is it just a masculine hand, whereas the person that's conducting the seance might be very feminine, and it's, again, this sort of dualistic idea of, like, the conduit versus the reality.
And then, you know, again, this sort of the vagueness of the time, but, you know, when people describe something that's tall and covered in hair, you're like, okay, well, that's a little bit different than, you know, somebody who has hairy palms or something.
Well, I do want to bring this more into the realm of Bigfoot and away from fairies and adolescent girls, which just seems like maybe we should just bring this back to Bigfoot. I wanted to ask you guys about notable cases that had cases of Bigfoot sightings that would be more common knowledge that also have the hallmarks of what you call the high strangeness inherent in the case.
Well, Tim, this sounds like you're bailiwick.
Yeah, one of my favorite examples of this is in Volume 1, and it is what is generally known as the Ape Canyon sighting. And if you're not familiar with this, it's a story that's told in almost every, like, general Bigfoot book that's a survey of the Bigfoot phenomenon. They will tell the story about these miners who were in the mountains in Washington State, and they encountered a Bigfoot creature, and they shot at it during the day, and that night, a group of creatures came back and attacked their cabin. Very harrowing tale, and varies from the original article in which they were saying there were stones were thrown, and then it got exaggerated over time, and some accounts have boulders being thrown and, you know, crushing the cabin, and so forth. The creature's lifting up the cabin, you know, actually trying to flip it over and so forth. So these accounts vary, but the story is basically the same. At least that's the story we were told. However, in the course of researching this book, Josh came upon Fred Beck's story. Now, Fred Beck was one of the miners who was at Ape Canyon. And he wrote this in the 1960s, looking back on the incident. So the Ape Canyon incident happened in the 1920s. So he's looking back on this incident in the 1960s, and he wrote this book with his son describing the incident. Fred Beck had a quote, which I will read, which kind of gives away the entire nature of the Ape Canyon incident. And this is, again, from Fred Beck. He was one of the miners that was there. And he says, "First of all, I will say that they are not entirely of this world." By they, he's talking about Bigfoot. "I know the reaction we experienced as these beings attacked our cabin impressed many with the concept of great ape-like men dwelling in the mountains, and I can say that we genuinely fought and were quite fearful, and we were glad to get out of the mountains. But I was, for one, always conscious that we were dealing with supernatural beings, and I know the other members of the party felt the same." So Fred Beck himself says these were supernatural creatures, these weren't natural creatures. And he goes on to tell the story of Ape Canyon, which begins with these miners encountering what they described as a giant Native American spirit, which told them to follow a white arrow into the wilderness. So they're following something in the sky. Is this a UFO? What is this? You know, I don't know, but that's what they say. As they're following this arrow, they encounter another spirit. And they do not describe the spirit's appearance, but it was a woman named Vander White. And they described her as a kindly spirit, and she made such an impression on them that they actually named their gold mine the Vander White Mine. And they follow this arrow then into the wilderness. It leads them to this mine. It's apparently a fruitful, productive gold mine. But in the course of working this mine, they start hearing strange sounds from underneath the ground, like big machinery sounds and humming, and they start finding footprints, but they were finding things like two footprints in the middle of an acre-wide sandbar, so along the river. So there's this acre of sandbar, soft sandbar, and two footprints in the middle of it. And they couldn't figure out how these two footprints got there. There's no coming or going, just two big human-like footprints. And eventually they started seeing creatures around. Now, the story as it that it's told did happen, according to Fred. They did shoot at one. The creatures did come back and attack the cabin that night, and they left. But all of the strangeness has been what I call weirdwashed out of the story to present it as if it sounds the most like these just a gorillas, you know, some kind of wild gorilla or relict hominid attacking these men in the wilderness in all these Bigfoot books. But if you read Fred Beck's own account, all of this other strangeness is folded into it, including things like apports. He had a pencil appear in his hand. He said he knew the pencil was at his house. I think it was like 50 miles away or something. His house was. He needed a pencil at some point. A pencil appeared in his hand. So you're having these weird, completely supernatural incidents, which the Bigfoot community has completely edited out of the story because it doesn't fit the agreed upon idea that these are just natural apes. So all of this weirdness is completely edited out, and I feel it's completely, completely wrong. I mean, I think it's, if you're going to believe somebody when they say they saw a giant ape man in the woods, you also have to believe them when they say there was weird sounds and footprints that disappeared and all this other strange stuff that Fred Beck himself reported. I think, Josh, you came upon a quote from which one of the researchers was it? The sort of big names in Bigfootery?
I'm not sure of the quote you're specifying, but I would imagine that was probably DeHinden.
Yeah.
he was famously antagonistic against this sort of thing.
Basically said that Fred Beck was crazy, right?
Yeah. I think that he got silly in his old age or something like that. It was either him or John Green, not to besmirch anybody unnecessarily. But you know, there are two other additional wrinkles from the Ape Canyon case too. One of which is also in Beck's account, which was a large white arrow in the sky. Did you mention that?
I did. That's okay. The arrow they followed to the mine. Yeah.
The large white arrow, and also something that I found that I don't know if anybody's connected this to the Ape Canyon incident, but it's got to be describing that. There's a 1967 article from October in the Oregonian newspaper that talks about a 1924 incident involving miners near Kelso, Washington, that had seen apes that threw stones at the cabin in the Mount St. Helens area. And they found giant footprints around the cabin, but all of the right foot.
Yes.
The search was called. Yeah. So we have this additional wrinkle, just one-footed Bigfoot. Now, of course, the article dismisses this as a hoax, which is, you know, understandable. But again, it's another little extra anomaly to the Ape Canyon case that just is not ever really addressed. And I think Tim probably thinks this is more intentional than I do. I think it might just be people being unaware or something. But I think in this case specifically, I do think in other cases people deliberately leave out all the weird stuff.
I do love the idea of the just half of the footprints. I think that's a wonderful representation of the book in general, and that it's this idea that he's both half here, half physically present, and half not.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. I know you guys have talked a lot about trying to hold two opposing thoughts at the same time, and there's no more of a great, I think, symbolic.
Well put. Yeah.
Than having just one footprint there.
No, absolutely. And this is something people are going to look in. Where do they talk about this? That's in the trackways, and the anomalous trackways are in volume two. And there is an entire tradition of monopods throughout myth and legend throughout the world. And the trackways of one single foot, I wouldn't say, I had to look pretty hard for them. So they're not exactly common, but they do occur from time to time as well. And between what you said, that being a nice metaphor, I think the other nice metaphor was something that Tim discovered in the Ann Slayton Alberry book, Bigfoot, which is out of print. But it's really, as Tim has described before, sort of the progenitor book for this, or the grandfather book of this. And it was a zoologist from the Baltimore Zoo, right, Tim?
Yes.
That said this? Yeah. I can't remember the exact quote. Maybe you can help me out on that.
Well, again, it was not the exact quote, but he was shown some of the footprints that were appearing in the area of, you know, Pennsylvania and Maryland in the 1970s, and many of these were three-toed footprints. And we can talk about how that doesn't make sense as far as primates, if you'd like, but in any case, the zoologist is looking at these casts of these three-toed footprints, and he had this wonderful quote, which I'm sure he meant as a joke, but it was very, very prescient, I think, as far as, you know, the things we're talking about. And he said, when looking at these casts, he says, it's almost like they forgot to form the rest of the foot. Like, whatever it was manifested and forgot to form the rest of the foot. Like, it only formed part of the foot. So, again, it's this wonderful sort of quote that talks about this phenomena not being wholly here, in a sense.
And if you look to compare that to, for example, the Jin tradition of the Middle East, which you can vaguely, loosely describe as sort of Middle Eastern fairy analogs, it was always said that the Jin would, you know, imitate things perfectly except for one detail. And what better detail to fake than, or what better detail to overlook, I guess, than the feet. Like, nobody's going to be looking at my feet. I'm just going to throw something together. Three toes, yeah, sure, whatever, it's fine.
Well, there isn't there always there, this, there's always some sort of ironic twist, whether it be with gifting or, you know, there's always, or intent, there's always some slight snafu that sends you on a path that was different from the one that you initially intended.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you just spoke about to this the other night. I said the other night. I don't know when you recorded again the last episode of Where Did the Road Go. Soraya should pay me for all these plugs. I think you, Tim, was saying how hard it was to write a straightforward linear paranormal book unless you're dealing with a specific case. Like, you're always branching out into these other points of comparison.
Yeah. It's in fact, I'm writing my chapter for volume two. That's the case study that I'm covering, and I wrote specifically that point today. It's not a line, it's a spider web, and a very tangled spider web. And you have to jump back and forth in ways. It's very, very difficult to write about this stuff because of that, because something will happen, and then 12 more things will happen, and then something else will happen that's kind of connected to the first thing, but only through symbolism, and you kind of have to make this all work together. It's very, very difficult to write about.
You know, it just occurred to me, Tim, is that in my case study for Volume 2, I opened it with the Gordian knot metaphor, which is basically the exact same thing that we're describing here.
To get to your point, Alan, back to your point, yes, there's always something that seems to be off in some way. There's always something, there's always a hitch, there's always something not quite right. Evidence always seems to disappear one way or another, or be somehow inconclusive. There's always a hitch. There's always a problem. It's very, very interesting.
See, I'm gonna push back against that a little bit, Tim. Sorry to interrupt, Allison. But like,
no, go ahead.
This is something that we run into a lot, though, is that the people who do have these like roadside crossings sightings, or a hunter who sees like a Bigfoot walking through the forest and then goes behind a copse of trees or something. There's not always a weird aspect in that, and I think that's the reason that you see those people lining up in the flesh and blood hypothesis camp more than the weird camp. Whereas if you look at people who have a longitudinal experience, such as habituators or people who have multiple experiences, then they tend to lean, or at least willfully ignore other hypotheses.
I would argue back that the thing that's off, the thing that's not quite right, the problem is manifest in those cases in the number of people that will never believe those hunters or those people that see that roadside crossing.
Fair enough. The defense rests, I guess.
Are there examples of this in, like, you know, for someone like me who only knows a few, like, I don't know all of the little third and fourth tier Bigfoot cases, but, you know, just even just like in the Patty case, are there notable things that happened around that time in that area, even like a meteor shower or something, anything that just was a little, can you think of something specific in that area or something else that might've happened to the, and I can't remember, I'm sorry, I can't remember the men who saw him.
Patterson and Gimlin. I write about this in volume two in a chapter on disappearing evidence, and it's one of my favorite examples because there's this beautiful video which shows something. I think we can all agree it shows something walk across the frame, whether it's a man in a suit or a creature. It shows something upright walking across the frame. you can get experts to line up on both sides as to it being a hoax, as it to being a real creature, and they have their various reasons, and these everyone from special effects experts to, you know, people who research primate locomotion and so forth. And as many people as you can get to line up on the side that it's a hoax, you can get, you know, experts to line up on the other side. So they can't agree on that. There's a fellow named Bob Hieronymus who came forward and said, I was the guy in the suit. And I think this is just this wonderful thing. So he says he's the guy in the suit. He's unable to produce the suit. So the one thing that could, for once and for all, determine whether this film shows something real or fake cannot be produced. It's lost. It's gone. The evidence, even though it's not, you know, Bigfoot evidence, if it's true that there was a suit and he was the guy in it, this evidence cannot be produced. It's gone. It's missing. He said it was like in his mom's garage or something, and then it disappeared, or it was in a trunk of a car and it, you know, got lost somehow. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter at this point. It's gone, if there ever was a suit. The film itself, which would be very valuable, I believe if we had the original film canister, they said they could determine what speed it was filmed at, and then they could, from the speed of the film, they could determine the size of the creature, which would be very, very valuable information, and something they don't, you know, would basically they don't know, because they don't know what speed it was filmed at, if it was a normal human size thing, or it's something, you know, considerably larger, something 7 foot tall, or at least, you know, not outside the realm of human height, but something that would be, you know, very, very rare for a human to be that tall. So if we had the original film canister, we could determine also likely whether this thing was a hoax or not. And the original film is missing. Now, some people say it's in some lawyer's office or it's in some film archive somewhere, but again, it doesn't matter. You can't produce it. No one can produce the original films. If you can't produce it, it might as well be gone. So here we have this, you know, perhaps the best evidence, visual evidence anyway, of Bigfoot ever collected, and the film's gone, a film that's worth millions upon millions of dollars, the film is gone, and this suit, which, you know, this guy, if he had this suit, he could auction it on eBay and get easily $5-10 million for it. This suit is gone. So the evidence for either side of this, whether it's a hoax or real, is completely gone. It's so emblematic of the Bigfoot phenomenon that it's left as this question mark just floating in the air. I love the symbolism of the Patterson-Gimlin film for that.
And I would argue that like it's just baked into these phenomena, that sort of self-negating, let's cast doubt on ourselves so that no one knows if we're ever around. There's a great quote that I cite it so often I should just look it up and put it on a post-it note or something, but there's a great quote from the UFO literature about a contactee or abductee who is told by the visitors, he says, we want you to believe in us, but not too much.
Well, I mean, that isn't that kind of like the perfect thing about that film is that, A, it's an introduction for many of us of this, you know, of our generation or many of us just culturally into the Bigfoot phenomenon. So in some ways, I feel like it doesn't matter whether it's real or not. It perpetuates the Bigfoot phenomenon without whether it's real or not.
Yes. And I would go a step further, too, and say that, like, I think that most of these paranormal topics, it's not about the world knowing, it's about you knowing, you know, it's about you, it's about you being convinced or you having that experience and sort of forging your own path and being able to say, I don't know what the rest of the world thinks, but this happened to me. And I think maybe that might be the reason that actual hard proof is always so elusive in these topics.
And actually, I think that's what's the most compelling for me. I mean, it's not a big secret that I'm pretty skeptical of a lot of things that we talk about on Strange Familiars. But what really changed my mind as to whether other people were seeing things or just making up something for attention or just having a very convenient response to something that might have a scientific origin was when someone came up to Tim and started talking about something that he had seen. And there was this just absolute palpable fear and anxiety that just to me couldn't be faked in the way that somebody can say, oh yes, I ran across the road and I only caught a glimpse of it and it was hairy. And this was an entirely different experience. And to me, that's what I think changed my mind from no one seeing a relic hominid in the woods to people are seeing something. I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's quote unquote real, but people are seeing something.
I think that's fair skepticism, though. I think that's, you know, that's very fair to say, well, they're seeing something. You know, if that's all the further you get, I'm happy with that.
Well, I mean, and in some ways, it's just making that leap to know that your experiences does not mirror everyone else's experience. It's just sort of leaving yourself open to say, like, not every person experiences the same thing. So it opens things up and closes things equally, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally get that. And, you know, one of my favorite recent Bigfoot sightings was the fellow that was Gage, who was on our episode called The Beast, when he described seeing that creature in the woods with two of his friends when they were kids. They were like, I think he said they were like 9 years old. He saw a white creature step down out of a tree. One of his friends saw nothing, and he attributed it to that kid being a coward and not looking up. But I think it's very interesting that one kid sees nothing. And then his other friend, the third kid, you know, later in life, he talks to him and asks him about it. He sees a black creature step out of the tree. So, you know, they both agree a big hairy creature step out of a tree. But as to what it looked like and its intention, they both got different feeling from it, by the way. The kid who saw the white creature thought it was just kind of warning them out of the woods and protecting them in a sense. And the one who saw the black creature thought it was completely evil. But these two, the two that saw it cannot agree on what it looked like, only what it was, which I find just beautiful. It's just, again, it's just a beautiful metaphor for this phenomena.
And that shows up in, you know, it doesn't get talked about a lot, but that shows up in UFO sightings too, where you'll have a group of five people and three will see something in the sky and two won't, or they'll disagree on, you know, colored lights, the color of lights rather. And, you know, of course the nuts and bolts UFO researcher will either omit that or we'll toss the case aside because they're like, well, they didn't say anything, their stories didn't match. But I mean, you know, it never questions the idea that we might be bringing something to the table, as my friend Greg Bishop would say.
It happened to John and I recently at Site 7, where he's on his knees reaching out trying to grab what he said was a ping pong ball sized light, and I saw what looked like a little LED, like a little pin light, like, you know, just a pinpoint of light. You know, we both agreed there was a light there, but what it looked like exactly, you know, we apparently saw two different things.
Did you agree on colors for that, or?
Yeah, on that one for sure. Yeah, we both, it was white, but yeah, it was the size of it. And I was right next to him. I wasn't, you know, like 20, 30 yards away. I was standing right next to him. And it seems like we both saw something different, but both saw a light.
Which, I mean, I think that this hints at the role of altered states of consciousness in Bigfoot stories, which I actually ended up adding the Gage story to that altered states chapter that I have in volume two. Because I don't think anybody has really ever talked about the possibility of altered states of consciousness being involved in the Bigfoot phenomena. It's very much in vogue in fairy research and in UFO research, but nobody, I don't think, has really ever talked about that. So it's something else to look forward to. I think that story with Gage, when I heard that, I was like, oh, that's awesome. That's, you know, most people would be like, oh, it means that they're fabricating their story and their story's falling apart, you know, decades later. But I don't think doesn't sound like the case to me.
No.
Oh, is that a story of someone who admits to being under the influence of something during the time that they saw Bigfoot, or?
No, just the idea that it's perception that,
oh, okay,
that defines the experience. Yeah.
Though we do have some, in the Al Berry book, aren't there some stories of people being hypnotically regressed?
And, there are a couple of those, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and realizing that they had some time with Bigfoot that they didn't consciously remember.
Yeah, a couple of hypnotic regression instances. You know, something that we talk about that is also, you know, part and parcel with this is missing time. People have drawn conclusions between, well, you know, in Fairyland you'd go in for what felt like 3 days and you were in there for 3 years, or, you know, missing time is obviously a trope in UFO lore where people say it should have only taken me 40 minutes to get home and it took me 3 hours. But missing time is something that we talk about in volume one. That's something that occurs more often than I thought in Bigfoot encounters as well. The most famous and most and best example that I always think of is Wes Germer's experience, his Sasquatch sighting in the head with his brother, where he was like, it felt like it was 40 minutes, but we got home and there was 3 hours later. And famously, the the co-host that he had on the time, very much in the flesh and blood hypothesis camp, said, well, when you're under duress, time seems like it speeds up, which clinically, in clinical settings, that the perception of time slows down. Absolutely. In high stress situations. That's not even open for debate.
Yeah, absolutely it does.
But what about in, like, you guys talk about sleep paralysis. What about in sleep situations or dreams? You know, like, so often people say, well, I just nodded off for, you know, a minute and a half, and I had this dream that took place over the course of days. And
yeah, thank you for that, because that's actually where I was originally going, and I sort of lost the plot there. That's something that's you know, in dreams, but also in these psychedelic experiences. We talked to anybody who's had a DMT experience, and they literally feel like they've been there for...
lived another life.
A thousand years. I was in a band with a guy who was like, he was a really funny cat. He looked like a Muppet. And he was like, yeah, man, I smoked DMT, and I felt like I was away for years, but I knew it had to be only a couple minutes because the same episode of Star Trek The Next Generation was on. So, yeah, this time dilation thing is a thread that runs through fairy lore and UFO lore and these trip reports that people have on all sorts of substances, and kind of rears its head a little bit more often than people think in Bigfoot sightings.
I mean, could some of the experiences that people are having in the woods, you know, maybe at a time of exhaustion from just that hyper-focus either in hunting or in hiking where you might be exhausted, do you think that might be a contributing factor? Or do you think that this is like, I mean, because some people seem to be affected on like a spiritual level by it. They might be frightened and might not think it's necessarily physical, but they don't seem to have like a spiritual reaction to it.
I think it's a valid criticism. But again, if I'm generally speaking, it comes back to that the dilation thing. If I'm exhausted, I tend to think that, you know, minutes feel like hours and not vice versa.
Unless you fall asleep in some measure.
Right. Yeah. And also true. I mean, yeah, I think at least some of us have had some of these dreams that, like you said, feel like they take forever. There's even some people who are really into dream research, which is something that's never really, you know, never really lit my candle, so to speak. But some people who claim to have had dreams or been in comas where they literally like live like decades of lives with people. And they have a family, and then they come out of the coma and they're like, but my family, you know, yeah. Oh, you guys are cool too. But like my other family, what about them?
Yeah.
It's that episode of Adventure Time where he goes into the pillow fort.
Yep. Yep. Which is, there's a video of someone who does salvia on YouTube. At least there used to be, I don't know if it's still there. And it's, you know, this guy's whole salvia trip is filmed, and he takes one of these like super concentrate, you know, salvia is a very powerful hallucinogenic, and they used to sell it in super concentrated forms, which you could smoke, and it would give
like
you
over the counter at gas stations and stuff. Right? Yeah. It was crazy. I remember those days.
Yeah, and you'd have an insane trip that lasts about, you know, 10 minutes or so. So it's, you know, it's not like an all night thing like acid. You know, this guy, you know, smokes and his friend's filming it, and he just, you know, he's just zones out and goes somewhere else, and he's coming out of it, and he's just like, well, you don't understand. I had a family, and you can tell it's just like he's sad. Like whatever happened to him, wherever he went, he had a whole other life.
I think you might be talking about, there's a video clip of, I believe it's Duncan Trussell, who's a comedian. He's the showrunner on the Midnight Gospel series on Netflix and a frequent Joe Rogan podcast interviewee. And I think that he was filmed with a salvia trip that he had. And he described like living an entire life as this like aquatic humanoid. I'm also putting in mind, this is, again, Allison, please rein us in and bring us back to Bigfoot. But I've got to say this, because I remember hearing several like really bad salvia trips where people were like, I spent 4 years as a down comforter, I spent a week as a suitcase underneath a staircase. Yeah.
Yeah. I have friends who are very earnest drug takers who will not go near it after touching it once. So yeah, it's something that's not to be played with.
If you have a puppy, you may need help with things like potty training, fear and nervousness, barking, chewing on furniture or shoes, crate training, leash training, hyperactivity issues with the puppy. For all these issues and more, you can turn to 90 Days to the Perfect Puppy. You can find them at sithappens.us. Look at the top of the page for the 90 Days to the Perfect Puppy link. 90 Days to the Perfect Puppy teaches a relationship-based approach to helping you and your dog become perfect for each other. They have lots of online sources, video lessons, a secret Facebook group where you can interact with other puppy owners, as well as the 90 Days to the Perfect Puppy staff. There are one-on-one options available as well. Let 90 Days to the Perfect Puppy help you understand how your dog thinks and apply proactive training methods. They'll teach you how to train your puppy, but also they'll teach you what not to do, which is very important as well.
Absolutely.
Again, find 90 Days to the Perfect Puppy at sithappens.us. Look for the link at the top of the page. So we'll continue on the next episode with the rest of our talk with Josh, Where the Footprints End. In honor of Josh.
Yeah, I've chosen some fairy children.
For the photo of the week. Josh is somewhat opposed to that sort of gentle Victorian fairy
kind of look. Needs to get over it because...
This is a real photo postcard. You got a guess on the date, roughly?
It's actually pretty early because I can see it's like a silver gelatin.
Oh, wow, yeah.
Real photo postcard. It's French.
So 1900 to the 19-teens sometime, probably, for the date on this.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful photo of these two children dressed as fairies, though.
They're in sort of, like, diaphanous gowns and with painted-on fairy wings and standing next to a fountain.
Really, really nice picture. You can find an image of this in the show notes for this episode at strangefamiliars.com. If you click on the image, it should take you right to our Etsy shop where you can purchase this beautiful real photo postcard, hand-tinted, of some fairy children. So I have to say, you did incredibly well. You really held your own in the Bigfoot conversation there. Is that just information absorbed through osmosis of being around me? So
absolutely. Yeah. I felt badly that I stumbled over things that I should know that are like canon. Patterson, Gimlet, I like just blanked on it, but you know, I do that sometimes too with things that are...
Oh, it's okay, yeah. Whenever I'm on Where Did the Road Go with the round tables, there's people in there that can list every like UFO sighting by date and all this. I just do not have that information at all. I'm kind of left in the dust by those guys' knowledge on that stuff. Besides the photo of the week, you can find copies of Where the Footprints End in our Etsy shop. You can find that link in the show notes as well. Those copies will be signed by me, not by both Josh and I, unfortunately. He's in Georgia, I'm in Pennsylvania. I also just restocked the Strange Familiars t-shirts in our Etsy shop. If you're looking for the classic Awoken Tree logo shirt, we have all sizes, small through 3X, in stock right now at our Etsy shop, as well as past photos of the week, original artwork from me, and a lot more. It's Etsy shop name Lost Grave, one word, or you can find the links in the show notes, like I said. We have a really cool on-site episode that we will be recording this week. You probably won't hear it for a couple weeks because we have part two of Where the Footprints End next week, but something to look forward to.
I think there's going to be a lot of natural reverb. It's going to sound really good.
Little hint from Allison on where we might be going for that. So a lot more coming up on Strange Familiars. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll be back soon with more. If you like what we do, if you want to hear more Strange Familiars, and help us create the show, you can become a patron at Patreon. It's patreon.com/strangefamiliars. $3 a month gets you those extra episodes and other content. But there are all different levels there. You can check it out. Go to patreon.com/strangefamiliars. And of course, we want to thank our patrons for helping us make Strange Familiars. We could not make the show without you. So thank you very much, patrons. If you want to help and you don't like the idea of a monthly subscription like Patreon, you can go to strangefamiliars.com. Look in the show notes under every episode. You'll find a PayPal.me link where you can make a one-time donation. Everyone can help by sharing the show on social media, by liking and subscribing wherever you're listening, and by leaving us those nice 5-star reviews, which helps get the show in front of new potential listeners. Strange Familiars is a production of Dark Holler Arts. Music, books, art, podcasts, and more, darkhollerarts.com. Intro and background music is by Stone Breath. Go to stonebreath.bandcamp.com for more. We're on Facebook, facebook.com/strangefamiliars, where you can join the Strange Familiars gathering group. And we are on Instagram, @strangefamiliars.
There's blood in the hall. There's blood in the Harlem, where the lady did fall. There's blood in the basin, there's blood in the bed, there's blood in the cradle, where the baby lies dead.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Save big money at Menards. Let the fresh air in and keep the bugs out with replacement screen for your doors and windows from AdForce. It's easy to install, durable against the elements, and comes in a variety of types to suit your needs. Repair your screens today with a roll of replacement screen on sale through May 5th. And check out more great deals happening now in our weekly flyer on Menards.com.
Save